All right.
Okay.
All right, Richard, how are you doing?
Very good.
Nice. So you've been, you've already been introduced pretty much to the radio show. I've talked a bit about, you know, who you are and what EcoCity is all about. But I wonder if you can maybe give us a bit of an introduction and tell us who you are, essentially. And basically, I'd like to know, it's a big question, I know, but maybe in the context of exactly what EcoCity Build is all about and how it fits into the framework of what's going on with, in particular, North American culture these days and, you know, industrial civilization.
Okay, that's a lot.
It's a lot, but I think that, you know, you have a pretty good philosophy and principles driving what you're doing, so if you want to go from there, that would be great.
Okay, seldom do people ask me, who am I, as a start lead-in here, but basically I'm a fellow who has been involved in environmental movement activities and art a lot. I used to make a lot of sculpture, and I think that has something to do with getting interested in cities, because my art was one that's very three-dimensional, and I rather like building things, and also, I grew up as the son of an architect and saw that a lot of what was being built didn't make much sense to me, and so I drifted rather naturally into looking at the structure of cities. Also, just a little biographical background, I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which a long time ago was founded as a very pedestrian city and has very cozy little narrow streets and compact building structure, and the whole thing was very convenient for many hundreds of years for people on foot. And not only that, but rather recently, within the last 20 years, it's become probably the United States' most solar-oriented town in its new construction. But it also has, by the way, one of the worst public transit systems I've ever seen, being almost totally non-existent. But in any case, it has good solar, it has interesting history, and it is a pedestrian city, and I think that had a lot to do with where I'm coming from and the kind of perceptions I might have. But the whole idea of the ecological city is to build a city that uses ecological principles that you can glean simply by looking at nature, and then to make the city fit nature a whole lot better than it does now, which it doesn't. So that's the basic notion. The idea is to get away from the car, sprawl, asphalt, oil-dominated city, and to think through what would be required for the city of the future facing the reality of much more expensive energy, and also facing the truth of the matter, which is that we've paved over probably the best agricultural land and much of the natural landscape of the planet, and there are ways by which we can actually retrieve vast acreage that has been very inadvisably developed and make our cities much more compact and pedestrian-oriented and work better with transit and so on. So there are many, many details within all that, and that's quite a long story, but I'd like to follow it in any direction and your listeners may be interested in pursuing it.
Well, one thing I was really interested in is maybe you can talk about some ways that we can create living arrangements that, like, it's one thing to have, you know, a minimum ecological footprint, but can you talk about ways in which we can design a place to live that actually give, like, use nature as a healing tool, essentially, like to actually give back more than we take instead of just have a zero ecological footprint?
Yes, in fact, ecological footprint's interesting to me because I think it's proportional to the actual physical footprint, maybe even a lot more than proportional. In other words, right now, we have an ecological footprint that's defined largely by the amount of energy we burn to unite the city. In other words, for people to be able to get from one place to another, we have to have these enormous scattered infrastructures of asphalt and supply automobiles with gasoline and so on. And I think that this amounts to a very, very large chunk of our ecological footprint. So if we get the physical footprint of the city down, that will make a very big difference. And you ask about the health of the whole city and what that might have to do with ecological city design. And there are many dimensions to that. There are tools by which you can bring creeks back into the city, which are healthy because the water can then percolate through the soil instead of running off on concrete and asphalt and return to the water table and nourish the springs and so on, plus also filter out a lot of the poisons that we generate in our society these days. And you can use such tools as, say, transfer development rights, which allows a developer to build a taller building somewhere in town if that developer also pays for not just a little more healthy. Mm-hmm. You can create rooftop gardens. You can plant native plants in the city to attract native insects and birds. There are many, many strategies by which we can bring nature back into the city. Many people say, well, why emphasize bringing nature back in so much? I mean, it's people live in cities. They have what we do. We could use less energy in what we do and so on. But why is this emphasis that I have, for example, in trying to restore creeks and protect ridgelines from which you can see sunsets and so on? And I think the simple answer is that our cities have gotten completely out of touch with nature. They've become incredibly exploitive. What's going on the frontiers of the American empire right now to maintain that empire, conquering foreign countries for oil sources so we can keep our cars running and so on, is disastrously unhealthy. And so what we need to do more than almost anything else in the modern world, it seems to me, is to recognize that cities need to relate to nature better. So there are many, many ways that that can be done. One of them is a very interesting little design detail that I call the Keyhole Plaza. Now, we have in Berkeley and Oakland, California, all sorts of schemes for opening up creeks, and we've actually opened up some in a few places. But say your city doesn't have a place where you have a waterway that's a very wonderful and very biologically rich feature to bring back. It's possible in some places to create what I call a keyhole or a view plaza. And what that is, it's a ring of buildings around a plaza in the usual way, but you leave out a corner facing something that the local people feel is a real natural treasure. It might be a mountain, it might be a bend in a river, it might be a waterfront facing out to the sea, it might be any number of things. But if there is a feature that is a natural feature that the local people really like to celebrate, create a plaza that's open to that view. So you frame the view with the higher density, larger buildings of your community and have a really wonderful place for the public to gather and at the same time take part in looking at the best of the human product, the cultural product, which is the buildings that in turn frame this wonderful piece of nature. So items like that you can be very conscious of. You can design this sort of thing into cities in the future, and you can tune cities up to nature, and I think it, for many, many reasons, that is a very healthy idea.
Mm-hmm. I definitely, even like, especially psychologically, to not only see concrete everywhere we look, but to have a natural site featured even makes that more prominent in our own minds, I think. And that kind of leads me to another question. I was wondering if you could maybe, if you're able to talk about how cities affect us psychologically, like, and even spiritually, if you're able to talk about that a bit, if you care to, just like what effect it has on us to always be, as far as the separation of nature and how perhaps, or the ways, what you're doing down in California can kind of turn that around a bit.
Well, psychologically or even simply educationally, what we're building has a message to it. When people walk out on the street of most modern cities, they see that everybody wants an automobile, they want something that boosts their ego, they want the convenience of going any place they feel like, any old time they feel like it. Cars are a hazard to people that are walking, the little kids on bicycles. We're getting a message constantly, call it psychological message or call it a message in education. The city is telling us that we don't value the human body and our children as much as we do the vehicles and the streets and the everyday preoccupations that have us hurtling back and forth in these gigantic objects that weigh thousands of pounds. Instead of protecting the little bodies of the children in streets that are pedestrian streets, we just write that off. There's a message in all that, and I think it's a psychological capitulation to a lot of unexamined motivations that people have to make more money, to have more silly, stupid fun, you know, just cruising around at high speed. I think it's a pretty pathetic image of what we're doing if you actually look honestly at the psychological level of what the cities are teaching us. I think that we could imagine a future very easily in which you design protected areas that are quite wonderful for the children, where you have pedestrian streets that everybody can enjoy, whether they have disabilities, they're older. I'm getting older myself. You know, we all are, but I'm in my 60s now. I want a place where it's where you feel like you can relish life and in a comfortable, slower pace and feel comfortable about everything. So these cities we build are these gigantic concrete platforms with impersonal buildings and hurtling machines and vast consumption of fuel and distractions about passing fleeting fads and fantasies that may have very little to do with survival in the long term, have very little to do with an appreciation of evolution, of geology, of the biology in our region or its ecology. All these things can be easily ignored in the city we live in. If we could redesign the city to re-sanctify all those things in nature that have been left out as we have built this mechanical monster, that's not just the city, but it's the city and all its tendrils that reach out there for oil, all the bombers that fly over the Middle East, you know, all the troops out on the fringe of the empire out in the frontier lands that America has established now deep into Central Asia even. I mean, all this is connected with the city. All of this fuels the city. All of this is really part of a psychological and I think even a spiritual collapse of many, many things that are of value. Mm-hmm. So the city is not just something that's incidentally there that we wander about. We've created it and influences us absolutely enormously, but it's interesting to me that so few people even look at it that way.
Yeah. It's a very holistic sense of looking at the city like that, which is what I really like about what you're doing, what you're writing about, is because you take it down to the fundamental things we need to question. And that brings me to another thing I really liked about some stuff I was reading on your website, which is that I think it was by Kirsten. She was writing about how there's this new campaign, like the Jumpstart Ford campaign, that's trying to help Ford produce more energy-efficient cars. And this business has been put on by the Sierra Club and Rainforest Action Network and Global Exchange. But I didn't really think about this too much, but a lot of people don't realize that energy efficiency and cheaper travel is most efficient at empowering people to destroy more of nature and keep on sprawling out. And so in a sense, the better car makes a worse city.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that for our listeners out there, because I've never really thought about how these energy people champion these energy efficient cars, but they actually just... they're almost like band-aids and pat on the backs, in a sense.
Well, not only that, but they could be. I mean, the theory that a lot of the environmentalists have that are promoting the energy-efficient car is that if you could get people involved in a small step in the right direction, for example, being interested in and having a car with a little less impact on the environment, that would be a good thing. And then people would take the next step and maybe the next step, and pretty soon they'd be environmental activists and they'd be growing vegetables of their own. They'd be involved in maybe even redesigning cities in the sense that you can vote for one kind of a zoning law or put into place some kind of an incentive in taxes to actually pay for opening up creeks and enhancing the transit system, et cetera, et cetera. I find instead what happens is most people do just a small number of things and their lives are so busy with so many other survival aspects or just the aspects of raising a family or holding on to your job in tight times or one thing or another like that, that in fact they'll do one thing and stop. And so the deeper question becomes, well, what does it mean to promote in the society running around for less money, running around in cars, farther distances, moving all that metal, steel, glass, and rubber at high speeds about a landscape and doing it in a way that is, quote, more efficient? Well, what it's most efficient at is making it possible for people to live farther out from the center. It's expensive in town, so it's cheap out in the farmlands. Just pave over the farmlands now that we have a vehicle that can travel farther for less money. In fact, that's exactly what does happen. So the energy-efficient car actually causes sprawl to develop more. You have to have what's sometimes called a holistic view of this. You have to engage in systems thinking, as they sometimes call it, or ecological thinking, in which you see how the pieces fit together. And if you do that, you begin to discover some interesting things. What looked intuitively like a good deal, driving farther for less money and for less gasoline and less pollution and so on, if you extend it through time, only a few years, and if you look at the impact on the city and you discover that it causes more sprawl, it causes more people to drive farther, and actually causes people to buy more cars, and even though they're a little more energy efficient, you have a drain that is even larger on the fossil fuels or whatever else you're going to use for energy. It could be electric from electric energy and batteries in cars from solar collectors or windmills. In that case, maybe it's a little bit better, but think again, because you're requiring the paving, you're scattering the landscape, you're covering the agricultural land, you're killing 45,000 Americans a year worldwide. It's up over, I think it's about 500,000 people. It's astounding, the impacts of perpetuation of the auto sprawl empire. And that's exactly what these environmentalists have tripped into. I don't think, really, that they know they're perpetuating the whole empire of cars and sprawl when they promote buying cars that are more energy efficient, but in fact they are. And the ecological perspective as compared to the environmental perspective is what gives you the information there. In other words, environmentalists are out to defend the environment, which I think is a very good idea, and I certainly am an environmentalist in that sense. But the ecologist insists on knowing how all those pieces fit together, how whole systems really work. And when you figure out how whole systems really work, you discover that the Prius isn't about to save us. The Prius is actually a way of keeping the sprawl, automobile, asphalt empire growing. And so it's a very misguided and very destructive approach. And it's a real tragedy that has taken us so many years to figure this out. And in fact, we had Dennis Hayes as a speaker of the conference that I organized in 1990 called the First International EcoCity Conference. And in that, he posed a puzzle. He said, how is it that after all the victories we've had in the environmental movement, and they're very substantial in many, many ways, saving species and stopping large-scale pollution and so on, how is it that with all those victories we are losing the war? We have, among all the really large issues, gone backward. We're seeing global climate change that is the most stupendously gigantic phenomenon that humans have unleashed upon the planet. We're seeing rapidly approaching peak oil production. After that, we have no idea what sort of crisis is going to result when people can't get anything done because you can't travel anymore and you've built a system for traveling. The collapse of species around the planet is awesome and terrifying. And so we've done all these things in a traditional way, which is to patch up little pieces here and there, put smog devices on cars and make them run a little farther on a gallon of gas. And it is not working. It's patently failing. And here you have the largest environmental organizations in the United States, and I assume trying to do the best they can, though one wonders, because they're now funded by these gigantic foundations that get their money from the empire. So I don't really know what's going on here, but I know it's extremely dangerous. And the puzzle that was put forward by Dennis Hayes when he said, how could we be winning the battles and losing the war, is answered simply by saying we never did deal with the largest things that human beings create. We've never dealt with that. The largest things human beings create is the city. We have to look at this gigantic thing and say, what can we really learn about this in its most basic functioning? Well, what we can learn is we're building car sprawl, oil, asphalt cities. And we can also discover that there are plenty of signs around that we could be building pedestrian, bicycle, streetcar cities that run strictly on renewable energy. You get the energy demands down so low that you could afford solar energy and wind energy, even if it is a little expensive, because you'll be using very little of it. Well, these are the answers to the big problems, and it amazes me that I'm very obscure. You know, I try to put these ideas out there, and practically no one listens, and no foundation will touch me or my organization. So there's actually only one. It's a very small one called Foundation for Sustainability and Innovation. And they put in probably 10 or 15% of the money we have to operate on, and the rest of it comes from scattered members. So it's a difficult road, but it's something that people should explore very quickly, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, I like that. I like a lot of stuff you said there. I like the difference between environmental thinking and ecological thinking. And ecological thinking provided more of a systems thinking, a systems approach to that. One thing I was thinking of was, have you ever heard of Derek Jensen?
Heard of what?
Derek Jensen.
Derek Jensen?
Yeah.
I don't think
okay.
so.
He's a writer, and he's a pretty good writer. Anyways, I played a talk of his on the radio earlier, and he's a staunch believer that cities are inherently unsustainable because they It's like they involve a large number of people living in a relatively small area, and they conventionally they've required vast amounts of imported food, which then leads to the destruction of cultures and ecosystems elsewhere. So I was really curious to ask you, if we're to maintain some semblance of the current population and still live in cities, and food production is obviously a huge question, how do you envision it's possible to, say, feed, like, even a small city of 100,000 people in a manner that doesn't require unsustainable industries? Like, what do you think that is possible? And if so, what are some ideas you have for that?
Well, you know, the amount that people have explored ecological city design and compact development and so on is pathetically small.
Mm-hmm.
We have very little idea what could actually be done in that regard. I draw dozens of pictures about it. I think that if the things that I imagine and draw could be built, they would run on far, far less energy than we have now and so on. But if you're looking at the unsustainability of cities, the scattered village can be just as unsustainable or even worse.
Mm-hmm.
The structure of the city that we have developed, probably coming from the city, involving cars and asphalt and scatterization, has affected villages as well as cities all over the world. Look at the American village that goes up and down a strip in a farming country, and you see the feed store is way down the highway in this direction, and you have a bank over here somewhere else, you have franchise restaurants here and there, you have the hardware store disconnected from everything else, everything surrounded by a gigantic parking lot, and you may have a big box store like a Walmart somewhere that serves regionally, and everybody gets in their car and drives over to that to save a few pennies. It's an insane infrastructure all the way from the cities to the village. Now, we have a planet with 6.5 billion people on it, and if you dismembered the cities, if you say, a lot of people say, well, let's don't have any buildings over four stories. Well, there are hundreds of millions of people who live or work or both over four stories up in the air. I'm at the fourth story of a building right now, and I was at the 10th story of a building just a few months ago when I lived in downtown Berkeley. You cut all those people off, where are they going to go? Hundreds of millions of people, maybe even a billion or more, that are in the cities right now. The agricultural areas could take some of those people, that's for sure, but 6.5 billion, I kind of doubt it. I think that we're way overpopulated in the planet in general. The interesting thing about the ecological city is it could help in that regard because it delivers far more services per person with far less damage to nature. Now, the idea that all cities are intrinsically damaging, I don't believe for a second. So I think that everything human beings build exploits nature in some sense or other, and it can be pretty much in balance, and we can give back our excrement, and we can give back into recycling those systems, most of the things we use in our systems that give us various goodies that we find, quote, indispensable. You know, other things we can certainly dispense with.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we can dispense with is the vast numbers we have if we really are concerned about a healthy future, because I think with a systems view, you want to have an ecological city, you want to have organic farming, you want to have a smaller population so that the base demand is down, you want to have less consumption in general, you want to have a lot more discretion about what it is you value in accumulating your life and what the impacts of those things actually are on the world. So if you take a holistic view of it, you could say that in some ways the cities are destructive, but until you actually explore what kind of city, you're not operating with a full deck of cards, to say the least.
I think it's a pretty good answer there. I'd agree with you that overpopulation is a pretty big problem. One thing I was thinking of was sprawl, because it's facing like communities all across North America and the world at large as countries continue on this progress path of quote unquote development. But particularly, I think up here in Guelph, we're dealing with the same issues you're dealing with in California of sprawl and pavement just carpeting the land. I was wondering if you have any examples of ways you've worked to prevent sprawl or turn back sprawl, and any tools you know of, legal or non-legal, that people around there are doing to prevent further sprawl and kind of turn it around.
Well, you said two things at once, prevent further sprawl and kind of turn it around.
Yeah.
Which are two different things. Now, the tools for preventing sprawl are well-known and well-practiced, and they involve all the tools for establishing and enhancing and growing green belts.
Mm-hmm.
And the green belt is usually created by taking open space and legally protecting it somehow. One of the ways to do that is something called the transfer of development rights, which I think is an extremely good tool to use in saving agricultural land and natural land. And by using that tool, or in using that tool, what happens is the developer is given rights to build a larger building or a development in an urban area, where in theory anyway, transit works better and people have access to the town. It's already developed somewhat anyway. And so more development there is kind of, quote, natural, unquote, anyhow. With this thinking, you can have a developer buy the rights to build in the town or immediately adjacent from a farmer, say, that's out in the countryside, and the rights to develop are then stripped from the deed so that the farmer can't sell that land to a developer. So say the farmer wants to make the money that he could make or she could make by selling the farm. The children don't want to be farming anymore, or something like that is going on in the family. You never know. It's all very diverse from one family to the next. But in any case, they decide to sell to a developer simply the rights to build. So the farm can stay there. They no longer have the rights. The family can stay. They can use the building. They can go on farming if they want. But they've gotten a few $100,000 or $1 million or whatever it is by selling the development rights. And now they can send the kids to college or take a easier retirement or whatever they're interested in. But that does, in fact, put a deed restriction on the land such that it preserves the land. So that's one of the many tools for preserving land. Now, what we've been talking about in my organization, which is called EcoCity Builders, is using a particular kind of transfer development rights that actually opens up the landscape. And that goes much farther than simply slowing down sprawl development. And in fact, I'll get back to that in a second. A lot of greenbelt strategy is to increase the greenbelt by buying the land or legally locking it up in various ways to make the greenbelt a little bigger here and there. Very expensive proposition and sometimes very difficult politically. But all you have to do is put a new highway through the green belt, and you have something that's another and a larger form of sprawl, which is leapfrog development. We have right now in the San Francisco Bay Area, just approved by the voters, which is a very bad deal in my mind, of making another bore, as they call it, through the mountain. There's a tunnel that goes through the mountain here, three of them actually, called the Caldecott Tunnel. And they're now planning a fourth tunnel through the mountain. That will go through the green belt, pop out the other side, and there's going to be more development far away and more people pouring along that highway. It's a very bad idea. So what's most important is not to just slow down development, as in the case I described earlier where the farmer sells transfer of development rights for development in the city, but to actually reverse that development by getting rid of some of the development that's already in the wrong place. And there's a really good example of that in South Lake Tahoe, which is in California, and on the border with Nevada. And in South Lake Tahoe, there's a transfer development rights ordinance that says if the developers buy a house that's on the edge of the lake and it's causing erosion of the soil and the soil is running into the lake, which is a bad deal, then that developer can buy the house, remove the building entirely, demolish the building, recycle the building materials, tear out the foundation, plant native plants, and then get bonus development credits elsewhere in that region. Presumably, if I were designing the law, I would say that would be adding to mixed-use development in the downtown of one of the communities around the bay there, around the lake, I mean. So in any case, that is a transfer development rights ordinance of a sort that can actually make it possible for people to remove development that's in the wrong place. In Berkeley and Oakland, California, my organization has been promoting and sometimes succeeding in opening up creeks and bringing the creek back into the urban areas. We have quite a few creeks here in the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area, and a lot of people like the creeks. So we've managed to do that in a few isolated cases. However, the creeks run underground through 85% of their courses in just Berkeley, for example. And there are concrete culverts that hold these creeks in prison, you might say, underground. And right on top of them or immediately adjacent to them are houses, and some of these are are beginning to fall into the crumbling culverts that the creeks are currently running through underground. So we would like to, and our organization would like to have an ordinance that says the developers can buy these buildings at market rates, remove the buildings, and then get a bonus to build a taller building in downtown Berkeley or Oakland. And therefore, the developer can make a little bit of money by paying for and removing the building that's on a natural resource like a creek. So that is a very active way of shifting the density. And I think unless we can establish tools like that to build in the right place while removing things that are inadvisably built in the wrong place, we're not going to be able to move very quickly towards ecological cities, and we're not going to be able to move very quickly towards solving problems like peak oil, climate change, and species extinctions.
I think those are some pretty great ideas there. I like that. And takes me to one more thing I was thinking of. I think it was in a writing of yours that wrote where you said that it's feasible to have civilization running on 10% of the energy we use now. And I was wondering if you can maybe suggest or talk a bit about some projects that you at the folks at EcoCity Builders are running down in California and ways you're working towards that. And maybe just talk a bit more about some projects you're envisioning and how they're playing out right now.
Well, a project by itself, of course, is not a whole city. I mean, a whole city could be a project. I've suggested to the Chinese, and I've been there four times in the last 4 years, that they might like to do whole experimental cities, but few can do that. And by the way, they're so enthralled with the automobile, they're highly unlikely to build experimental pedestrian cities, experimental transit cities, or experimental bicycle cities, which is what I was suggesting. But, you know, I tried, and it is possible to do new towns that are like that, and it's very possible over the course of 50 to 100 years, I think, to reshape whole cities in a way that I'm describing, using transfer development rights and so on. And until you actually deal with the whole city, you're not going to be running a city on 10% of the energy by any means. But where I get a figure like that is to look at Europe and understand that some cities there operate on one quarter or even one fifth of the energy per capita as some of the American behemoths that are sprawled out over enormous landscapes like Dallas-Fort Worth, Phoenix, Arizona, Los Angeles, California, Atlanta, Georgia, and on and on. These things are gigantic, flat infrastructures with little dense blobs of structure in the center of the city. And they suck up incredible amounts of energy and have enormous damage to the landscape. Well, you could change the entire infrastructure of the city following the kind of notions that I lay out, but few people are likely to do it anytime soon. Hopefully they'll do it sometime eventually. What you can do in a relatively short term is to do projects that our Australian colleague by the name of Paul Downton, an architect in Adelaide, Australia, who, by the way, also hosted the second International EcoCity Conference in Adelaide, Australia in 1992. He has a term for what we've been promoting for a long time in EcoCity Builders, and that is urban fractals. Now, you know, a fractal is a pattern that is replicated at different scales, one held within the other. They sometimes call them nested patterns, one within another. And you're probably familiar with fractals in geometry, where one swirly pattern you magnify and you see there's similar swirly patterns deep inside it. A similar phenomenon is the deltas that you can have that are as large as the Mississippi River Delta or that are as small as a little delta in a pond in your backyard when you're watering your garden. So these are fractals, one of another. And you could build projects in the middle of a city that have all the basic essential functions of the whole city in just a couple of city blocks. You couldn't do it in the scale of just one building, but you have a cluster of buildings, a public plaza, an opening of a creek. The buildings could be facing the sun in a way, in a cool climate where you want to collect solar energy. They could have greenhouses on the south side. They could have rooftop gardens with natural trees and so on, attracting the natural birds. You could build, in other words, little chunks of the eco-city, fractals of the larger whole city, and then people could walk into this environment and say, aha, that's what ecological cities are all about. Now I'm beginning to understand. Until you actually have built projects and imagery that's obviously stronger than the imagery that I draw, because people aren't building that yet, but if you could actually have these built projects of a buildable size, you know, a size that's politically and financially feasible to build, that shows how all those pieces fit together, then you have something to show people to say, this is how the whole system works. Now, this could be a little city center. It could be a neighborhood center, say maybe built around a keyhole plaza that looks out from the fringe of the city into some beautiful view. It could be a whole conference center, college town, eco-tourist resort someplace on a beautiful piece of coastline. It could be any number of things that are at the scale of probably starting around $10 million on up. And these things are buildable, and if we could find developers who want to do it and find willing city governments to simply allow it, I think we'd have a financial winner that was actually running on a tiny fraction of the energy that we now use. Where I get the one-tenth the amount of energy starts with just the European model, and this is just very much back of the envelope, you might say. But if the Europeans can run cities on one-fifth the energy and one-fifth the land area, and the cities are already contaminated by a lot of cars anyway in Europe, then if you actually intentionally created a city that was also using solar greenhouses, rooftop gardens, and green building materials, recycled building materials, excellent insulation, and on like that, active solar, both heating and active solar electrical, then you'd have something that'd be quite a magnificent example. So these things are buildable, and if you extrapolate to the whole city, I think you can easily imagine a city running on 10% of the energy and 20% of the land that we now use for cities. And I think that is the largest solution you can imagine for climate change, species extinction, and the problems coming with peak oil.
I think that's a pretty good summary. I wonder if you have any further things you'd like to say, definitely including some information about EcoCity Builders and how people can learn more, but if you have any further things you'd like to talk a bit about before we finish off.
Well, I think one thing to consider is that many people who are very concerned, very conscientiously concerned about coming peak oil and the economic dislocations we can expect from that have a rather rapid-fire personal response of feeling very troubled and some real sense of desperation of what you can do if a lot of people are suddenly unemployed, you can't get where you need to go anymore because it's just plain too expensive in the infrastructure we've already built. And a lot of people say, well, we will build a solar greenhouse and we'll put in a little orchard in our backyard and a vegetable garden in the front and we'll hole up and try to get through this thing. That's not on the scale that's going to help us very much. If things disintegrate to that level, I think we'd be more likely to see what I saw evidence of when I visited China, which is the large-scale clan houses that are built essentially as forts. In other words, I think we'd likely see a situation in which there are marauding bandit armies and warlords taking over things. It'd be pretty bizarre, and something we haven't seen in the Western world in a long, long time. And China's seen it not too long ago, back in the 30s, 40s, and so on. But in any case, to avoid something like that, we have to get organized on a larger scale. The people who are starving to death, who are well-armed, aren't going to just sit by and starve while some people have nice permaculture gardens and solar collectors on their houses. They're going to come for them. So if we don't organize on the scale of at least the scale of a city, getting healthy in its bioregion with some real civility at the core of its values and its laws and its zoning and its building codes and so on, we're going to be in very, very serious trouble. So what I'm suggesting here is that it is definitely not enough, though you're going to start thinking this way if you think about peak oil, to simply protect yourself, your family, and work with the neighborhood. It is not at a scale that's going to be very productive. You can do that, and I encourage it. I encourage all those levels. I've built solar greenhouses. I've planted urban orchards. I've restored creeks, and all those small-scale things are, in fact, valuable. But you cannot neglect the design and the policies that create the ecological city at the same time. You're going to have that also. So I want people to be alert to the political realities that we have to have good government. We have to understand that we can create policies, and we can even have the policies of supporting businesses in the usual green building sort of ways, where you You promote having energy conservation and recycling and good insulation and so on. All that's very important. But if you leave out, as the environmental movement has left out, confrontation with the built environment and what that really means, we're not going to survive too much longer with that extraordinary dislocation. So that's my kind of warning and my prescription to how to get through this phase, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges we face, that's for sure.
A lot of what?
A lot of challenges. A lot of challenges.
Yep, sure are.
Yeah. And how can people learn more about what you're up to? You want to share with us your website?
Well, we have a website. Yeah, it's ecocitybuilders.org, www, of course. And you can get a little bit of an introduction that way. We have a post office box in Oakland, which is post office box 697, Oakland, California, 94604. So if people want to be in touch by mail, they can do that too. If you're really turned on, you might like to join the organization and send us $35 and to that address and get our newsletter and get tuned in to what we're doing in a more activist sort of way.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on here in Guelph right now that's kind of similar, but nothing quite on such a comprehensive scale, so I hope that some people out there have been pretty inspired by you today.
Well, hope so. Keep working at it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking with us, Richard. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for calling, Matt.
Okay, no problem at all. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.